What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. It's the Sunday debate, and for today's podcast, we're teaming up with Slack. I'm putting in a few extra hours to bring you a special discussion around what is the ideal length of the working week. If you enjoyed the episode and want to find out more about Slack, visit www.slack.com/digitalhq for a host of valuable resources on how they're supporting their clients. Now let's go to our host for today, the journalist and broadcaster, Anne McElvoy, with more.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Anne McElvoy. I'm executive editor at The Economist, and welcome to this Intelligence Squared event in partnership with Slack. Tonight's question, is it time to abandon the five-day working week? Well, it's a lovely Monday out there, and that feels like a very good time to think about it to me. But this question more broadly has gained relevance, of course, since the disruption of COVID-19, which forced governments and businesses to revisit that old Monday to Friday model. Proponents now argue that the pandemic, in that sense, did us a favour. This was a trend that was already coming on because of digital working and desire for more home working and work-life balance. It also allows a lot more flexibility, and you could argue that it broadens out the workforce, and particularly those with children might be remarkably grateful not to have to get out for the 8 till 6, 9 till 5 or beyond grind. So there are some of the benefits. Productivity rises for employers, employees are happy with lots more autonomy, and you can go to work in your yoga pants, or maybe that's just me. There is a sceptical case as well, and that is that tampering with this well-worn pattern of work, a cadence that most of us understand intuitively and are trained into from the start of our careers, is perhaps more of a disruption than we have bargained for, and it might blur that line between work and the rest of life and create yet more stress. So let's try and delve into this and understand it a bit better. The speaker who is going to lead us off tonight is Bruce Daisley. He's a former VP of Twitter for Europe, Middle East and Africa, and host of the podcast Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, in which he interviews psychologists, neuroscientists and workplace experts to understand how we can improve our jobs. He's also the author of two books, The Joy of Work and a forthcoming title, Fortitude, Unlocking the Secrets of Inner Strength. So there, Bruce, with all the fortitude you can muster, it's over to you to get us going.
Yeah, I think to some extent the debate about whether we work becomes 4 days or changes to some extent misses some of the broader picture. And I think what we're witnessing is an unbundling of the way that work has been constructed till now, a renegotiation of some of the perhaps unnegotiables that we were confronted with before. And actually, relatively, the question of how firms are embracing this is determining the experience for employees right now. So I think when we look into the evidence, there's a lot of suggestions that employers are in various stages of denial and various stages of grief about how they try to reconcile the changes that we've just witnessed from the way they're going to pass those changes on to employees. And the fascinating thing for me is that it's a good illustration that some of the firms that probably have tried to position themselves as market leading have taken some big missteps. So I went to work at big tech companies because they gave the impression that they had a better workplace culture there than anywhere else. It was only when I got there that I realised that I'd just been hoodwinked by wonderful marketing. I'd been misled that somehow they were wired in a different way. And I think that's some of the challenge that we've got right now. The companies that have had the most public missteps, Google, Apple employees, have used Slack to self-organise. They previously didn't have a way to contact each other internally. Now they've used Slack to self-organise to say that we think that the fact that we're being asked to come into the office 3 days a week seems regressive and is maybe against the fact that we've earned more autonomy than perhaps we're being offered right now. So I think, you know, there's various stages of denial. It's interesting, the mindset of founders seems to be determining to some extent the flexibility that workers are getting. But to my mind, the debate about 4 days a week could end up being a slightly too mechanical change for we've just fundamentally renegotiated some aspects like timeliness, like place that maybe we considered non-negotiable before. So I think it's an illustration of the great unbundling that we're witnessing. A lot of things are up for grabs. The really interesting thing is if you look into the extremes, to finish my bit, but Professor Raj Chowdhury from Harvard Business School strongly is of the belief that the norm for all elite businesses going forward will be work from anywhere. And the reason why he's convinced that work from anywhere will become the defining norm is because top talent is asking for it. And in the same way that we've seen workplace culture evolve in the last 10, 15 years, because top talent has maybe gone to technology companies that have positioned themselves in a different way, increasingly top talent wants to have the flexibility. So Raj Chowdhury is convinced that you either buy into this or you become a dinosaur firm that effectively can't attract the best workers. So for me, it's a fundamental renegotiation. In the short term, I think the four-day week debate is interesting, but I think it's only a hint of what the debate that's really opened up.
Thank you very much, Bruce. I think that's fascinating insight into the work from anywhere. I remember that first request that came in on a team I was involved with, and we looked at it as if it was like, what, you want to work from somewhere else? I'm like, how's this here? And now that, as you say, it would be very much a norm in a part of a negotiation and may, as you say, go further and faster than we've taken on board. Elizabeth Uwabinini, you're going to take us on now. Elizabeth is author, brand strategist, columnist, also for Financial Times, and co-author of the award-winning book, Slay in Your Lane, The Black Girl Bible, and more recently, The Reset, Ideas to Change How We Work and Live. It's like you guessed we were going to have this event. Over to you.
I pretty much agree with Bruce. I think that the conversation around this 5 day week versus 4 day week is much more nuanced than it's currently being played out. I think if we look at the old system of, you know, 5 days a week, it was, you know, laden with presenteeism, burnout, inflexibility. And I think now rebooting the same machine and just pushing it into a 4 day week isn't going to work for, like you said, a lot of top talent, but just currently just the way things are right now. So I'm a big believer that, you know, top talent will go to where people are going to be more flexible and allow them to have, I guess, autonomy over their work. I think that was one of the things that really came out of COVID and people working from home. You can work from home or work in the office if you have a manager or management style that is essentially, you know, quite oppressive. It's going to lead to some of the things that we see around anxiety and very much and burnout. So I think that we have to stop being so black and white with some of the discussions that we're having around work and have much more nuanced conversations. If not, we're just going to reboot the same machine and head for another crash, essentially.
Do you think there's a generational component here as well? Because I framed it, and this probably reflected my own generational experiences, like, oh, my life would have been very different in a high-pressure job with three children had we been having this conversation a few years ago. But I think you're also reflecting the view of those about top talent, but emerging talent in companies. Do you think they think differently?
Absolutely. I think we all want the same things, but I think maybe emerging talent are a bit more vocal. And I think they're very much aware that they have a life outside of work and they want to have a more community-led approach to how they work. So side hustles and things like that. I don't think that they see work in the same way. However, I do think that if you have three kids and you still have the same sort of like challenges, and you do want a more community-led and more trust approach to how you work. So I think that across the board, we're pretty much asking for the same thing. However, I think possibly emerging talent and the younger generations are just more vocal and essentially not having it, basically.
They're just not having it.
Yeah.
Well, that decision sounds like it's been made. Carl Nicholson. Carl leads Slack's executive engagement for EMEA. He's an engineer turned technologist with a big interest in using technology to enable people to do their best work. And before Slack, Carl was co-founder and CIO at Synaptic, a digital innovation company with the goal of connecting people, process and technology to get work done. Now, Carl, that sounds like quite hard work, but I think you also have a view that it can be a lot more pleasant and a lot less stressful if we get some parameters right and are prepared to change some things.
It is. So to answer the question and to get it off my chest the first time I speak, I don't think the question really is, should we abandon the sort of the 5-day working week, that sort of construct we've all grown up with, or I certainly have. To me, this is all about flexibility. And what flexibility really means isn't just whether you sit at home in your yoga pants and attend meetings all day. It really is about having the choice of when you do things. That brilliant intro you just gave me, thank you very much. Myself as an engineer, the sort of 9-to-5 pattern, although every contract I've ever had with every employer I've ever had has said that I do a 40-hour week, the truth is I very rarely did. And that's not because I'm a diligent, hardworking individual. It's simply because in technology, which is where I've been my entire career, things break after 5 o'clock and on weekends and all the rest of it. And so I realized very quickly that to be successful in tech, I needed to be extremely flexible in my approach to work, and no way was I ever going to turn around to somebody and say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to fix that right now because it's past 5 o'clock, because that was the quickest way to get fired. But back to the question, flexibility and what do we really mean by it? I think you need to enable tooling, processes, even down to the HR and the way that you write your contracts to allow ultimate flexibility for your people. And as the great points have already been made here, it's about talent. And also it's about diversity. It's about diversity because we know in the tech industry that to create really great products and services, we need the most diverse bunch of people we can possibly find that represents, you know, the public. And I think that's one of the biggest changes I've observed in my career. You know, my first job was a bunch of white guys, and it was purely men. There was not a single lady in the firm. This was a software engineering company, and we all looked very much like each other, and we all grew up in very similar circumstances. You fast forward to somewhere like Slack, and it is a hugely, hugely diverse workforce. And so I think your flexibility, your working practices, the way you go about stuff ultimately has to fit that workforce and way of working. Because if you get this wrong, to Bruce's point, people will just go out elsewhere. And I don't think it is necessarily age related. And one final point, the Future Forum, which is partly funded by Slack, tells us in a global survey that they run every quarter of knowledge workers, 95% of people right now across the whole age spectrum want flexibility in their work. Gosh. So for me, it's about flexibility, not working days. It's about when work gets done.
Great. We might dive into what the consequences of that are in just a moment, but let's hear from Nick sitting next to you. Nick Snercek is writer and academic specialising in the future of work and currently a lecturer in the digital economy in the Department of Digital Humanities, King's College London. That's probably a department that didn't exist if we'd been talking 20 years ago. He's an advocate for the 2-day work week, hurrahs all round, and author of books including Platform Capitalism and a forthcoming book, After Work, The Fight for Free Time, which will be published, I got to say, sometime in 2023.
When I get the work time to finish it,
yeah. You get it done. So yes, I think people could be fascinated by your 2-day week.
The 2-day work week, I mean, this is Keynes's basic idea as well, the 15-hour work week. So fit into 2 days quite easily. So it's not actually that radical of a proposition if you look back to the 1930s when Keynes is sort of talking about, you know, in the midst of the Great Depression, what the future holds. And people often think, well, this is a crazy proposition. But he was actually just vocalizing the common sense of the time. It's interesting that we've sort of forgotten that period now. I mean, my work is all about why we need less work, despite the fact that I spend a lot of work trying to make that argument. But I want to begin here in my opening spiel, sort of 3 points of agreement. First is that I think work, particularly globally, not just talking about, say, top talent, but globally, is largely harmful to workers, devoid of dignity, monotonous, crushing, and without fair pay. Wages in the UK, for instance, we've seen more than a decade of pay stagnation. The Bank of England now suggests that that's going to continue for probably another 5 years at least. We have more and more surveillance and monitoring of workers, less and less control over their own time, and that's in a developed economy like the UK. It looks even worse when you start to go globally. When we look at the future of work, it's largely healthcare. It's home healthcare in particular is the fastest growing job by a long shot. So the tech world is very nice, and I think there's a lot of interesting aspects of it, but it is a niche industry globally. The pandemic has only made things worse as well, as we know. Remote working is great in many ways, but what research shows is that people are now doing an extra shift at the end of the night. So we have to talk about the flexibility invoking more work. So my first point of agreement with, I think, everybody is that work has problems today. My second point of agreement is that nobody wants to add another workday. Nobody is advocating for a six-day work week. Nobody's advocating for the end of retirement or anything like that. And this suggests to me that we recognize the importance of free time. So we all agree that free time is significant. And this is my third point of agreement, is we value freedom. And I think maybe where I might differ is that I think freedom fundamentally is opposed to work. I think free time is the basis of freedom. Most people, when you're in your job, you're subject to the whims of your boss. You may have some flexibility over when to work, but you don't have any say over what you're doing, the expectations, how you're working with other people. So many people have no say over their work and they're dominated. They lack freedom by their boss. So I think most work is fundamentally unfree for most people. And that if we actually want a society of freedom, we have to reduce work.
Right. That's quite a challenge. I'm going to throw that. Thank you very much indeed. And I was very pleased we ended on that, because I think we had a broadly positive view from different angles from the first three speakers about more flexible work. But Nick's view was really the only way, if you wanted to have happier, more fulfilled people, was to have them work less. Who'd like to respond to that?
I think there's a lot of truth in it. I think the amount of headspace that our jobs are taking has grown and grown and grown to the extent that we often don't necessarily perceive it. One of the really interesting things to deconstruct those weird 2 years we just had, but you'll remember sort of in the first month where everyone was really trying to assemble what their life looked like between queuing for a four-pack outside Tesco's and trying to sort of work out who is going to cook the evening meal. Like, we were trying to reassemble. But I think people recognised at that moment that they were occupying a different place in their relationships. It's a really interesting thing to observe. There was some work amongst American teenagers. And that first month of the pandemic, when teenagers exhibited closer connections to their families, their depression went down. They seemed to be in a happier state because identified the domestic part of their life was enriching for them. And I think so we've seen those things change. The reason why so many workers now are citing flexibility as a reason why they want to change jobs is because we've actually been woken up to the fact that we were in something of a cult before, where we were getting up, we were leaving the house at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, we were coming home at 7 or 8 o'clock, and we were considering it as a non-negotiable, as something that was just part of having a successful job. And so the fact that those things, our domestic situation has been realigned, it does seem to be informing a renegotiation of how work sits in our lives. So I'd agree, freedom, that ability to consider that we do have part of our identity that isn't our jobs is quite liberating for us.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, I think it depends on how you see work as well, because if you seek purpose in work and your work is part of your identity, then maybe two-day work week just doesn't work for you. I don't know if it would work for me. So I struggle to work out what I'll do with my other time. But I like the sound of that, but I think it depends on how you see work and how, and that relationship you have with your career and purpose. I have friends who, you know, see work as a means to an end, and I have friends who are very much, you know, immersed in their work being part of their identity. And depending on where it doesn't really matter where you sit on that, I think the main thing is you shouldn't be driven to things such as, you know, having a boss that drives you to, you know, anxiety and an oppressive management style. So whatever you sit on that scale, I think you need to still feel like you've been treated as a human and with dignity. So I totally agree with what he was saying, sure.
But let's get down to what we want and the trade-offs here. I mean, if you're looking at productivity, I think the jury's still really out among any sort of longitudinal research about what productivity is going to look like in this world. And if we either work less, which was Nick's idea, or even if we have much more flexible working patterns. So we may know all the ills of the established working week, but we probably don't know what we might have to give up in terms of expectations. So, Carl, I'm going to throw this one at you. Is this really a kind of charter for people who are actually advocating really for lower growth and less competition, in which case they better come out and say so? And Nick, I'll come back to you on that in a minute, but let's get Carl's thought.
No, I don't think so, to answer your question. I think, to your point, and through my own experience, I completely agree with you. I know that there were times in pre-COVID where I needed to hit the stop button to give myself brain space or rest or freedom to actually think about the problems I was currently grappling with work. I needed the ability to kind of take a step back and think about stuff. And I think it goes to the question of productivity. I think we need to reassess as companies what is productivity. Is it the old measure of sat in an office, how many hours a day, or is it output-based? Because if I can achieve the same thing by working less hours from home, perhaps working in a asynchronous way, which for those of you who aren't aware, is whereby you can pass work and pass the baton around to people, and we do this a lot at Slack, we literally pass work around the world on a daily basis. It's just a better way of working because it increases the flexibility, which means people have more freedom to do the things that they love. They spend time with their children, et cetera, which ultimately means to me, they get more brain space to think about what it is they're trying to achieve. But to your point, Elizabeth, it's about your job and your approach to work. For me, I am everything. My job and me are one and the same, which some people here will probably tell me is wrong. But I've always worked places where I truly believe in what I'm doing and I'm immersed in it. That's just me as an individual. I appreciate if a job is just a means to an end to you, you probably wouldn't feel that way. So it's all about you as a company, the types of people you employ, the culture that you have, the way you go about doing your work, because it all goes into the melting pot of what's important to you. So if you want to drag everyone back to the office 9 to 5 every day and that works for your company, who are we to tell you not to do that? Basically, it is very subjective.
Nick, what about the challenge on productivity, as in what comes out? And usually, you know, if we're going to just measure it in terms of success, company formation, company growth, we are in a time where a lot of global economic problems are being made worse by low growth, or at least the anxiety that growth won't return or isn't returning fast enough after the pandemic in a sustained way. To what extent can you square what you want with that aspiration?
Yeah, I mean, there's two aspects. One is the productivity question, which since the 1970s, global productivity growth has been in decline. So we have major issues there. I think there are fundamental issues around measuring productivity in service-based economies. It's very difficult to measure the productivity of a service worker, of an office worker, anything like that. And then starting to look at, you know, digital companies is even harder. So there's issues around how we measure productivity. There's issues around a long-standing decline in global productivity anyways. I think the promise, or one of the promises of a shorter working week, is actually that it increases productivity. I know from my time doing office jobs that I spent a huge amount of time just slacking off because I didn't have time to do. I didn't have anything to do. Now compress that, you know, 5-day working week where I had to be there in the office showing my face along with the sort of expectation that you'd stay a bit beyond when you're supposed to go. Compress that into a 4-day work week, and I think you end up with a more productive workforce doing the same thing. So I think it can actually increase productivity. That's to the benefit of the global economy. On the issue of growth, I think there are really big issues with climate change. And I think lower growth is not necessarily a bad thing. It depends on what type of growth we're talking about. I think the evidence when we look at a shorter working week is that countries that have a shorter average working week use less carbon as well. They have fewer carbon emissions. So they have a lower impact on the environment. And the estimate that I saw for the US, for instance, if the US average working week moved to the European average working week, they would save about 20% of their carbon emissions. So lower growth is not necessarily a bad thing if it saves the environment. We have to manage that transition to a lower growth, but I think these big questions about climate change have to be part of the narrative as well.
I wondered if anyone wanted to challenge that, because I do think the low growth argument is a bit of a soft underbelly of what we've been talking about. It may well be true, and it is true, if you emit less carbon, you will, you know, you'll help the battle against global warming or global overheating, but you will also, you know, have more difficulty funding your public services. And you will also see, as we're seeing at the moment, you know, we have huge challenges in terms of where the funding is going to come from to take our societies forward. So I suppose just a last thought, you don't have to speak on it, but anyone would like to, is there a trade-off here? And should we be clearer about it, that you could, some people seem to say you can be just as productive. Carl, I think you were heading there. But there does seem to be some difference here between whether you want to be more productive or not.
I spent a while, a couple of years ago, before we went into the pandemic, chatting to different organisations who had more flexibility. So companies that had no offices or were completely remote. And the one thing that struck me, that I chatted to a couple of them, Basecamp is very famous for being this sort of office-less, flexible organisation. But if you look at the underlying performance of Basecamp, it doesn't perform incredibly well. It's a company of 70 people. It gets a lot of attention, but it's really a lifestyle business. Buffer's another one that, you know, it has this radical transparency that runs through it. All the salaries are published. It doesn't have offices, and yet it's a very low growth organisation. So one of the things that, you know, it's a fair challenge, is one of the question of posing ourselves is it the part of work that is unreasonable that achieves outstanding results? And it's a fair challenge. You know, when you look at exceptionally achieving organizations, they frequently have either a unique and monopolistic business model to them, or they have an approach to people that is unsustainable. So it is an interesting, fair challenge.
Elizabeth, what about the impact of teamwork and good work culture in remote working, asynchronous working, a phrase now going to start tripping off all of our tongues that we didn't really think about before? Is there a risk, though, of feeling less connected or even less committed, particularly if you're new into a company or you're more junior? Sort of the elders or the established are all fine. Well, I've known Biffy for 20 years. I can have 5 minutes sidebar with him and little jokes in the chat. But if you're new and you need a sense, or even rising in a company or an organisation, you might feel that's a bit alienating. What do you reckon?
No, I agree. You can't beat human contact. And it's really important when you're starting out in your career and as you go through your career, and as you progress to build relationships, the world of work is built up of relationships and networking. So I think that having culture that promotes that is even more important if we do 4-day week or work from home or remote working or anything like that. I think that it just requires different management style and just greater trust. I think one of my experiences of when I used to work in a corporate workspace, I think there was just a real, I'm a manager because I want to progress, not because I know how to manage people well and effectively. So I think it does require a different style, and a style that means that you know how to bring people together, you know how to delegate and give them responsibility and it not feel as if there's a weird like parent-child relationship in the world of work. So I think that it means that the way we use our high streets could change in terms of coming together, and what we use are the spaces. How we use spaces is different, and how offices are made up. So I think that there is implications for a different management style, but it's also implications for how we use office spaces as well, and how in terms of culture. Because if you're coming in to just sit at a desk every single day in a silo, what's the point of that? But if you're coming in once a week to meet everybody in your team and build really strong relationships, and you're in the office, and you're doing like a team bonding exercise or things like that, then that's going to be of greater use and be more effective than what we have now, which is, I don't want to sit on Zoom or whatever all day with my colleagues, but if I can get on with my work at home and when I'm in the office and I'm
collaborating. So you want a more experiential office. It's an interesting analogy, isn't it? We talk about that a lot in retail, that maybe the environment of a store has to change to being something more experiential, because you could also do your shopping online, but when you go into a store that you're like, you want, you know, there's something that
yeah, just got to be more dynamic as well. Sure.
Who else would like to come in on any thoughts? Yes, Carl.
I think this is a very relevant conversation. We at Slack all the time talk about the digital HQ. You may have seen our ads, and it's exactly this conversation. So I actually joined Slack in December of last year, and frankly, I was quite worried about it. I was joining a company a week after its acquisition. I was joining a global team. I was the first of my role in the world, so I had no prior art to really go after. And I thought, how am I going to onboard into this huge behemoth of a company that's now part of Salesforce from my little desk in Worcester? And I've got to say, it was an outstanding experience. And I'm not just saying that because I'm here in Slack sponsoring the event. It was an outstanding experience because, to your point, it was led with empathy. And our management at Slack is top dollar, quite literally. And they are excellent leaders. And they're excellent leaders because they understand the importance of transparent decision making. Everything that we do is on Slack. Shocker, I know. And so we've taken our office online. But that doesn't mean the role of the traditional, you know, bricks and mortar office is dead. It just becomes far more experiential, so that when we do get together, we're not just sat in the office for 3 days a week because management's told us to, sat on Zoom calls, which to me is a little bit crazy. Yeah. And is kind of that old model.
I find that weird. Especially when you see the person through the glass behind you on the same call and you sort of desire to sort of wave.
I mean, I've had calls recently where I've realised I'm in the same building as someone, which is just nuts.
Oh, yeah, my next door.
Very, very unhuman. But it is
different.
But
if you don't, I mean, can I just stop you on that point? Because that's a good little example of a sort of knobbly conundrum. I can understand also why that evolves, because you think, well, you can't have a system where if you're in the office, you're in some way advantaged. So you will have to have a Zoom, and we could all be sitting in five different offices, but we will have many colleagues outside. So how do you get around that?
Do you know what it feels like? It feels like we've got a road network and no one's written the highway code yet. And organisations are scared to write the highway code. And so as a consequence, we know very clearly there are certain roads that you can drive at certain speeds. There's certain parameters that you can drive at one way and you can't drive up another way. But right now, organisations are scared to lay out their highway code. I've been really inspired with the ones who say, almost like, how small can our footprint be in prohibiting your personal autonomy, but we are going to have a footprint. So I heard one organisation that I think about all the time, and they said, our organisation, our highway code is Wednesday plus one. And the idea behind that then, I guess, is you might say, well, either we're going to try not to have too many meetings on Wednesdays and we're just going to catch people in person. There's really good evidence that having a meeting-free day can be liberating for people. Or they're going to say, and the idea of Wednesday plus one is everyone in the organisation is there on Wednesday, and then we want the office to have a little bit of hum to it. So on the rest of the week, we want a few people to pick and choose. Maybe the finance team is in on Monday or whatever it is. But for me, it's like, okay, they've created the highway code. And so many, you know, I chatted to one organisation who told me that it's similar to what you just talked about with Carl there, that when one person's on video, everyone has to go onto video. And the consequence of that, I love the idea of it, the consequence of that is that people come to the office and feel like, I could have done this at home.
Exactly.
And, you know, the net promoter score for that version of hybrid work is going to be really low.
That's very interesting. Nick, I'll bring you back in. Please respond to anything you've heard. But something, there is maybe a more challenging point that we haven't reflected, which is, of course, if we're doing more work from home, and I know you want a much shorter, but not necessarily more constrained working week, you still think that there's a creativity to work. It does mean that, of course, digital surveillance is going to be coming much more into our homes. And I speak, of course, as a podcast host, an audio person who knows full well the risk of leaving your little backup mic running and finding that the file is full of this sort of subsequent argument that you had with your 16-year-old about what time she's supposed to come back. But that is, you know, just something I think we might also just be getting used to, that risk analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I maybe just speak a little bit about the sort of workplace socialization, which I think is really important and really good. But, you know, most people, you know, they have social lives outside of work. And they're quite happy to have social lives outside of work. And actually, you know, what they're being told to do is to spend 40 hours with people they may not like. You know, I'm sure we've all had many colleagues that we just, you know, despise. We don't want to spend more time with them. But unfortunately, that's
not
part of the job.
No,
of course not. Not on this show. But, you know, of course, this is, again, this goes back to the freedom issue, is that you're spending 40 hours of your week with people that you have not freely chosen to spend time with. It's great if you're friends with them, but I think most people in the world, you know, they have friends at work, but it's not their core social network. It's not their core people that they want to be spending time with. If they had a free choice, they would rather be spending it with family, doing a hobby, doing something else besides socializing with a colleague that you just happen to be sitting next to. On the issue of surveillance, yeah, it's a crucial issue for the coming years. there is, you know, massive surveillance of the gig economy, which is sort of the pioneer of a lot of these things. Huge amount of surveillance from companies like Uber and Lyft and Deliveroo. These companies tracking everything that their workers do. And now we're seeing that expanding to remote working. We're seeing it expand to office workers as well. And there is some pushback, but there's very little in the way of legal regulations about what can and can't be done. But right now, there's a real sort of arbitrary power by companies to basically surveil their workers in whatever way they want.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Before we go to our questions, let's just step back a bit, and you can really, I think, panel, just answer this in your own way. I thought we should look at what would the major consequences be for society of a change, or what are they, what way we're changing the way we work, and what might they be? Elizabeth, I thought I'd start with you and say, look, for years and years, ever since I came into the workplace, but more, perhaps more seriously in the last 10 years or so, equality, discrimination in the workplace have been themes. Employers have basically got the memo on that, and they need at least to be aware of what their company's values are and how they are projecting them. Does the debate that we're having today change that and enrich it? Or do you think it is like the same problems exist, they just exist in a different space-time continuum in more remote working?
In terms of equality and like just...
Yeah, I mean, basically, I do say to all of you, just answer this in your own way, because I think it's something people have their own experiences of. Do you think it changes anything bigger than sort of the future of how we work and productivity to a more kind of, to the social mix, to challenges around equality and diversity that companies have been looking at for years?
It's a very interesting question. I think it's just, for me, it's the same thing. I don't think that changing something to a four-day week or five-day week changes the makeup of an organisation drastically. I think that it's the same sort of like challenges you'll get elsewhere, in either one. So I think for me, when we talk about diversity and having a more inclusive workforce, it goes beyond like the kind of binary conversation around like where we work. I think it's more having a more community approach that's underpinned by trust and a much more empathetic workforce.
Bruce?
There's a couple of interesting things on that. Firstly, some data in Australia where Australia publishes far more of its gender profiling. So it publishes at every level of an organisation what the gender profile is. And if you look at the industries that have mandated a five-day return to the office or a four-day return to the office, there's almost a direct line correlation between their lack of diversity. So it strikes the consequence, it's impossible not to look at it and to think, actually, what you've seen is power of incumbency, that when men have benefited from a five-day week in the office, they've tried to mandate a return of it. And in fact, interestingly, again in Australia, one of the firms that was very public about announcing that they were going to a four-day week for productivity reasons, they announced that they found that 20% of their workforce didn't tell their wives that they'd gone to a four-day week, and they were still going to the office on Friday morning, messing around a bit, and then going out all day drinking or playing golf. And so they didn't pass on this sort of premium, this gift of the four-day week. So, like, you know, there are gender elements. Also, in part of the Future Forum's research, they found that they looked at people who were excited to return to the office. And of young workers, only 20% of young workers were excited to return to the office. But it was much lower amongst women, and it was much lower amongst black workers, principally because there were lived experiences either of daily sexualization for young female workers or from sort of hostility under the radar, hostility that they were experiencing. So anyone who tells you that flexibility isn't a diversity and inclusion issue is missing some of the big stories, I think.
Great, great angle. Sorry, Carl, you look like you just want a quick word and then we'll go to questions. Would you like to just come in for a
minute? You've stolen my stats. I have nothing to say. No, I did. Exactly what you just said, Bruce. I think the only thing I would add to that is me as a new parent, being at home for my young daughter was frankly a surprise, and a nice surprise, because as a senior executive within a technology company, I didn't expect to spend much time with my daughter at all. And being there for the first, you know, this important first year of her life is massive. And I think we won't really see the benefit of that for probably another 10, 15 years as studies come out, because I certainly didn't see my dad when I was a kid. And so for me personally, I think that's huge for dads to be around for children. Of course, mums as well. Means the world.
You're now an apple masher at a high level. You've got that consistency just right. So in this case, I'm going to start taking them and throwing around the panel, and we may be, you know, a little bit more quick fire on this one. What are some of the negative consequences that could come from moving off the five-day week? So that's a good, bold challenge there. And Nick, we haven't heard from you for a moment, so here come.
Yeah. I mean, so I've given a lot of thought to this, the sort of implementation of a four-day work week. And I think one of the most interesting challenges is the sort of scheduling issues. So schooling, for instance, is 5 days. Hospitals need to be open for 7 days. All these sorts of issues about, you know, moving to a shorter working week does involve impacts on these other major institutions of society. And we'd have to work out ways to sort of reorient them in better ways. I think it's entirely possible. Historically, we moved from 6 days of working, actually, you know, 7 days really of working, to having a two-day weekend. We've done this in the past, and we can do it again. So it's not impossible, but it is a challenge that needs to be thought about.
Further thoughts on that, Carl?
I'm worried about it'll be used as an excuse to pay people less, frankly. I think some companies will do the math and say, right, well, that's 1 day less you're not in the office or wherever, therefore you're going to earn 1 day's less pay. I also think the opposite could happen, not in terms of money, but I know I as a consumer love services and I can get support for those services 24/7. And so one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is if we did go to a four-day week, could we sort of stagger our workforce so that actually the business and the service of the business is open 24/7, but you as an individual are only online or working, et cetera, for those
so
4 days.
3.5-day work week.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And actually, what would the impact of that be on the business? Because I know as a consumer, I like to be able to call my bank at 10 at night on a Saturday. You can't do that with traditional companies.
Yes. Elizabeth, here's an interesting question. Elizabeth Uwebeneni, what is the situation going to look like for non-sedentary workers? And that we perhaps have fallen a bit in this panel and elsewhere into thinking of people who work at their desks and kind of that's their working environment. You know, what about cleaners, delivery people, carers, transport workers, etc.? Do you see the same flexibility being possible there, given that it is, obviously you can have shifts and timetables, but there are certain services that seem to go more with the rhythm of perhaps the working day, between light and darkness. Have you thought about that?
I wrote a bit about this for my book around the conversation around working from home being very much centered around office work and a whole heap of people being forgotten about. So I think that we need to kind of, I guess, include, be more inclusive in that conversation. And I think job sharing has been something that has been put forward as an opportunity and how we get around that.
It is, I mean, there is a tendency, a bias even, to think about this as something, because it's something a lot of professional workers care about, either Bruce or Carl, what do you think about that?
I think it's difficult, isn't it? And it all goes back to the, why do we expect things to be open Monday to Friday, 9 till 5? And the answer is history, isn't it? Really, if we think about it in the same way of why do we send our children to school on a Monday and Friday between 8 and 3.30 or whatever it is. And it all comes back to preparing us for the world of work, for mills, ultimately, in the Victorian Britain. And so I think this question is actually far bigger than just service workers. It's why do we try and fit everything on a Monday to Friday between those hours? And I guess, I didn't even know who we posed this question to, perhaps the government, of why can't we have a more flexible approach or where we have this job-sharing mentality where services are just open for us all the time?
Nick Sercek, because you perhaps were advocating one of the more radical positions on this. I mean, one reason is that it's a tension within the sort of progress itself, isn't it? That someone has sent in a question saying, let me get it up, should schools and universities stick with a five-day week? You know, if this is going to be a kind of source for the goose in the workplace, and what about for the gander, for the children and for students? Is that feasible, or do you think that this is really something that is closer to the world of work?
I mean, I think for universities, since I work at a university, it could definitely move to a four-day work week. I mean, the real issue, speaking at a central London university, is space. How do you fit all these people into central London? But a four-day work week is definitely possible. With younger children, I think it's a bit more difficult because I do think that sort of 5 days of education is quite crucial. But again, it's historically contingent, the fact that we have a five-day system of education. And the reason it's 5 days is because parents were working 5 days, or particularly the father was working 5 days. So, you know, there's no necessity to having a five-day system. And in fact, the way it's structured here in the UK is that, you know, getting off at 3:30, well, parents have to rush home early from work to try and be able to pick up their kids or pay for after-school care and things like that. So it's actually not set up very well. And you can imagine extending the day, compressing it into 4 days, quite simply, I think.
Got it. Right.
There's some interesting trends happening right now. So Leesman, the Leesman Index, run this benchmarking set of data about offices. And they've observed that, firstly, the usage of offices is significantly down. It's down by about 3/4 from what we used to have. But Fridays is down by the most. I think Fridays are currently looking at about 19 to 20% of the demand that they used to have in the old days. Now, I've found a couple of organisations, non-profits, who saw big opportunities in this. One organisation said, our job is to teach refugees how to code. And so they'd said, we've found loads of office space that's empty on Fridays. We're going to start using that space to sort of zig when the world zags. So it's really interesting. We are starting to spot the trends, emerging trends, where if we are going to observe that Friday has got a very different feel, whether we work on Friday or don't work on Friday, it's got a different mojo to it. And if we're starting to see adaptations of that, it presents big opportunities to, you know, those non-profits, those charities who want to maybe take advantage along the way.
Quite a lot of questions coming in with pretty tough challenges to what we've been talking about. So here's a couple that I'll thread together and just throw around the panel. No one's mentioned the link between pay and hard work. I work from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. in order to get paid a lot. This is Donald Cameron. This buys lots of things for me and my family, says Donald. So, you know, working pretty hard there. And another question, we haven't got a name on it, but I think it's an interesting one to add to that. For 200 years, the world has experienced remarkable growth while operating a five-day working week. Why fix what isn't broken? Isn't it economically risky?
I would argue it is broken. And you might be sat there thinking, well, 200 years, remarkable growth, you know, we're all still here. How many people do you know with mental health issues? How many people do you know who grew up with issues because they didn't spend time with their parents? You know, the list goes on. I think this has been broken for a long time. And I think the pandemic, I think people's attitude to mental health has changed. The ability to talk about it has changed. And again, to Bruce's point, I think pre-pandemic, I know certainly in technology, we were already kind of moving towards this time where most people would typically work at home on a Monday or a Friday. Most people would come in on a Thursday and go for a drink after work and be social. So this was already happening. I think the pandemic just pressed fast forward on it.
Elizabeth, what do you think?
I pretty much agree. I think that mental health is only going to get more pressing, and the services that we rely on are only going to get more stretched. And it's, you know, a bit fanciful to say it doesn't there is, it isn't broken, it's clearly broken. So yeah,
pretty much. Yeah. And what about that Keynes you mentioned earlier in that aspiration, Nick, to Zinecek, to the idea and the aspiration to a much shorter working week? It's also actually there in the pre-1917 Bolshevik writers, though that might not be quite the model you're shooting for here. But, you know, it's been around for a long time, but there is another view of it. And I have a question emailed in. It says, numerous studies have shown that work gives us meaning and fulfillment. People who don't have to work are frequently miserable and lacking in direction and purpose. Why does Nick want to take that away from us? Well, I mean, I think, in fairness, I don't think Nick's going to impose it, but you are advocating. Off you go.
No, I think this is one of the best questions about the sort of vision I have, which is meaning, you know, does come from work for a lot of people. But we have a society which is structured around that. If you're unemployed, you are vilified by the press and by every political party. You are unable to get basic things that you need for survival. You have to scrounge in order to be able to survive. If you're unemployed, to fill in numerous amounts of paperwork with a huge amount of surveillance, you are a lower class citizen if you're unemployed. And that's the way society is structured. So I don't think it's very surprising that people want to be employed, precisely because being unemployed is so terrible in this society. Now, what's interesting is that if you look back, say, 100 years ago, people like sociologist Thorstein Veblen were talking about the leisure society, the leisure class. Mm. And what people aspired to do was not to work hard, but to be the part of the leisure class. The aristocracy was what you wanted to be. And, you know, you would never deign to be caught working. And today is completely flipped around. But this shows the history of how people find their identity. It's not intrinsically tied to work. And we can have other ways of doing it.
Just going to try and fit in a last couple of questions. And remember, of course, if you're enjoying this and you have any challenges or thoughts, do tweet about the event using the hashtag IQ2. And you can still send in questions. I'll get in many as I can. And there's one that's just popped up, which says, what about small business owners who need to work 7 days a week to make their dream a reality? Wouldn't moving off 5 days a week prejudice those people? Who'd like to take that one? Well, actually, Nick, you continue.
Well, if they're working 7 days, the five-day work week is already, you know, it's already a constraint on them. I think the issue for me is that the four-day working week sets a minimum, and then you can work overtime if you want. You can work extra on projects that you find passionate about. The key thing is that you have the choice. You're not forced to do a five-day working week.
Any other thoughts on that? I mean, I think probably the sense behind it is there are, being a small business owner may mean that you do have to trade away some flexibility because you just have to sort of satisfy your customers or find your niche. And so there may just be more people. I'm looking meaningfully at Bruce here because, you know, you started us off tonight with quite a strong advocacy of change. And I suppose the slight mood of that question was, that's never going to work for me and people I know.
To sort of aggregate a couple of things from the last two questions. So the person who I presume is in consulting or management or in investment banking who says they work 14 hours a day. It's really interesting evidence. Firstly, there was a report in The Economist a couple of years ago saying that the amount of time people work, claim to work, has very limited correlation with the amount of time that they actually work. And in fact, the more you claim to work, the more inaccurate your estimate is. Elon Musk claims to work 130 hours a week, and you spend your time sort of totting up those numbers, and you'd say two things. Firstly, it doesn't seem to be doing him the world of good mentally. And secondly, you start looking at that and you start wondering where are the hours in the day to work
would,
that
I
amount.
I mean, as a fairness, BBC trained presenter, he would say that's not the case. I mean, he's, you know, fantastically driven. He's, you know, whatever people think, he's been massively successful.
Absolutely. But generally, when people claim, though, from the Economist data to work 100 hours a week, generally the actual end up figure is closer to about 45 hours a week. So I recognise that a lot of us feel like we need our taxi light on and we're working long hours. The amount we actually do is often more and a distributed amount across a full day.
Okay. Neil Diamond says, if workers work fewer hours, they must surely expect less pay unless they can demonstrate greater productivity, or I suppose the same productivity would be a fair ask as well. Most businesses will have to employ more staff. Elizabeth, is that just something that you recognise, that there is a big ask of businesses that might not just be about changing culture, which I know was your angle a bit earlier, was, well, culture needs to change. What about practicalities?
Well, I haven't run a business before, so I'm couldn't speak on that fully. But I do believe that businesses need to rise to this challenge. So I do think that there is going to be demand for more job sharing opportunities and people to work more flexibly. And it's not going to be, you know, an overnight thing. So I think definitely it is a challenge, but I think this is the way that the world is going. So it has to be kind of like worked on.
If you're ambitious to succeed in your career, won't it always be advantageous to be in the office?
I'll take that one.
Doesn't do you any harm. Anyway,
yeah, I mean, I think I'm doing okay.
There is a sense, isn't there, that there's, and we hear a lot about how would, is there a disadvantage to be?
I think in certain companies right now there is, and it goes back to the conversation about how we manage people in a distributed, remote, flexible workforce. I think there is definitely some sort of proximity bias going on in businesses, and I think there always has been. And that's why people did used to stay late in the office just to make sure that their boss saw them still at the desk as they left at 6 o'clock. I think we collectively as leaders need to demonstrate that that is no longer a measure of productivity or success. It's as simple as that. It needs to stop.
Let's go for a final round. I think some of you have answered along the way a bit more about how you work yourselves, but I would like to, I'd just like to get an insight into that. Nick, I mean, you put out there the two-day challenge. There was a bit of a sort of grouping around and some questions about the Wednesday plus one model. So everyone's in on a Wednesday and then the other days you can choose. Does that sort of model actually work out for you, the way that you work? And what have you learned if you have changed the way that you work?
Well, so I've got two young children, so that's changed the way I work fundamentally. The cost of childcare in the UK is so expensive that I can only afford it for 4 days. So I sort of necessarily have a four-day working week where my children are in at nursery. But I do enjoy my work. So I work after they go to sleep. I work sometimes on the weekends. You know, I'm sure I put in more than 40 hours and maybe more than 50 hours. But I'm one of the fortunate few that actually enjoys what I'm doing, and I happen to get paid for it. I think the real question is what the majority of the people in the world are doing is not something that they're necessarily passionate about. I mean, that's the real question of a shorter working week is for them.
Elizabeth, you combine a number of roles. You're an author and a newspaper columnist, also a brand strategist. Are you a blitzer, or are you a spread it out over the weekend? Clock off at a set.
I'm driven by deadlines, so whenever, and tend to be book deadlines. But I definitely think that just having more autonomy over the way I work and different projects have given me freedom and just general happiness. Do I get burnt out? Yeah, still. I'm not saying that, you know, the life on the other side is any more, you know, free from those things. But I think that there's a real sense of purpose in how I work. And I think that means that when I do clock off or when I do, you know, fall asleep or I rejuvenate, I feel more excited about the work I have to do. So it doesn't get rid of the things that we've spoken about today, but I think it just gives me a real sense of purpose. And I think that that works for me, but it might not work for other people.
Carl Nicholson, in the Slack environment you're always on, how do you decide when you're going to switch it off?
I'm going to rattle through this really quickly because I think the way Slack operates is really interesting. To your point earlier, I think we are writing the manual, getting things wrong and trying stuff out. So I thought I'd share it because I think it's interesting for the audience. So although we have physical offices, we've taken everything online in this digital HQ approach of Slack. We do everything in our own platform. We quite literally eat our own dog food on a daily basis. Most employees, almost all of them, have the option to work remotely on a permanent basis if they choose to do so. I'm one of them. Slack's senior executive team, going to proximity bars we were just talking about, are in the office no more than 2 days a week, and the rest of the time they work from home. The reason we do that, one, proximity bars, but two, it demonstrates to the rest of the organization it's okay to work from home and you don't have to do presenteeism, it doesn't matter. We have something called Fridays, which I absolutely love, which is one Friday a month off, and that's predominantly to get over the burnout of Zoom calls. If you've ever sat on Zoom calls quite a lot, it's tiring, and the more people on the call, the more tiring it is, not just Zoom, other platforms are available. And I think, last but not least, we also have something called Maker Time, which is kind of what you were hinting at earlier, although it is work, we are still paid, we do have to be there. And this is time to turn all of the meetings off, we have no scheduled stuff, and it's time to do whatever it is that you need to do. If that's sit in a coffee shop and think about something, if that's cracking on with a project, it doesn't really matter, but that's brain space where all the notifications stop for the day and allows you the freedom to do what you need to do.
Bruce Daisy, last word from you. You've worked in an organisation. You now seem to be, you know, have a bit more kind of freedom to choose how you work. So how do you?
I think what we haven't covered along the way is how bananas work is for most people, that most people sit there thinking, my work is intolerable and insane, and they kind of think, am I the only person who thinks this? So they're sitting on 25 hours of video calls a week. They're thinking, hang on, when am I meant to do the job here? So all these people are saying, who are saying on the questions that, you know, people, how are they going to get their jobs done? Actually, if we address that, if we freed people from all these video calls, people could do their job in far more sustainable way. I like to have, back to your question, I like to try and have a bit of different energy to Friday. So I try and get most of my stuff done. I try and sort of have a bit of playtime Friday afternoon. But yeah, I think the way that PwC announced last week Friday, summer Fridays, and I don't think they'll be alone in trying to suggest that if they're going to demand a lot from people during the working week, Friday's going to get a little bit of different energy to it. And I'm trying to have a bit of that.
Listen, thank you very much indeed to all of our speakers for insights. Definitely some thought-provoking ideas there. Let us know what you think about that on Twitter. I'm off for some downtime now. Thank you also to the audience, to Intelligence Squared, and to Slack. Good night.